This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Law and Order Week on the program. You just heard a remarkable story, the story of Lamont Armstrong, released after 17 years in prison. Now a very, very different story that fits into our Law and Order Week. This is the story of Janet Dunahay, who says it was just a prank. But the fire she set in an ex-boyfriend's apartment left four people dead. After being arrested for the crime, Dunahay accepted a life sentence to avoid the death penalty. And now, after more than 10 years, she's seeking clemency from the governor of North Carolina. She says that she never intended any harm. And the father of one of the victims agrees that she has served enough time. Our Greensboro Bureau Chief Jeff Tiberi is here to tell us more about it. Jeff, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So how did this all start?
Valentine's Day night, 2002, Janet Dunahay and a couple of her friends were drinking wine. They decided it was time to play a prank. So what started with the idea of going to the grocery store and getting some tuna fish oil or some tuna fish to pour down the air ducts, the air vents of her ex-boyfriend's car as a prank. So when he started it in the dead of winter and turned the heat on, it would smell terrible. It turned into something much worse. So they went to the grocery store. They couldn't find tuna fish. They ended up getting clam juice. Came back to the apartment complex. His car was not there. So the friends said to Janet, she said, I'm going to get out of the car. I'll meet you over at our apartment complex in a couple of minutes. She went up to the second story apartment where her ex-boyfriend lived in an apartment complex where 32 people were sleeping at that point. This is now almost, I think it's kind of murky, but it's late Valentine's Day, early 15th of February. And she sets a fire to a futon that is on a wooden balcony. And she uses lighter fluid to set the fire. So this fire goes through the breezeway of the building. It's a windy night. It's a wooden porch, and she used lighter fluid. So the fire gets pretty big. People wake up throughout the different apartments in the building. Some get out unscathed, not injured at all. Other people were trapped on the third floor, and they jumped from third-story windows, breaking legs, breaking arms, some pretty serious injuries. And there were four people, Ryan Beck, Beth Evans, and Beth Harris, and a pair of sisters, Donna and Rachel Llewellyn, who woke up and were leaving through that breezeway. And as they were leaving, the roof collapsed on them and all four of them died. So 28 people got out, and there were four victims of this who died.
And where was Janet in all this? Did they realize how serious the fire had become?
What Howard Newman, who was mentioned in the last segment, an assistant district attorney in Guilford County, told me was that after she set the fire, she left. She walked around the building and basically walked through the woods to her apartment complex building, which was 100, 200 yards away. And she didn't stick around to see the fire or realize how bad this got. She left the next day to go to Matthews, to go to her home. When she got there, she didn't tell her parents about the fire. She just said she needed to have some family time. And within the next couple of days, she was apprehended.
And her friends played a pretty important part in that, right?
She did. They did. The friends testified against her. They basically went to the authorities the next morning, told them everything that they knew, said that this had started as a Valentine's Day, Valentine's evening prank against an ex-boyfriend who, according to Howard Newman and others, it was an amicable breakup. They came to the authorities and ended up not testifying because there was never a trial, but they shared their side of the story, which was key in pinpointing her, apprehending
and
her.
They had the evidence. They had asked, they had the lighter fluid?
So there were some clothes of Janet Dunahay's that were found in a dumpster outside of her apartment complex. Shoes, clothes, and a lighter fluid bottle from that night.
And as you said, there wasn't a trial. She pleaded guilty. Tell us about how all of that transpired.
So in North Carolina and in 48 or 49 states in the country, there is a felony murder rule, which essentially states, and there's some variability between states, if you commit a felony and someone dies in that act, think arson, rape, even a bank robbery or something like that, and someone dies, you can be charged with felony murder. The guidelines and the sentencing varies from state to state some, but in North Carolina, if you commit an act of arson and someone dies, you can be charged with felony murder and face the death penalty. So Janet Dennehy was charged with essentially four counts of first-degree murder and was facing the death penalty. There was not a trial because she reached a plea agreement and she agreed to serve life in prison without the possibility of parole in exchange for not facing death penalty.
Right, and she's been in prison now for 10 years for that crime, and now she would like clemency. Explain what that means and what. Tell us more about that request.
So her legal team has started a push with letters, with a website, with the voices and support of some local prominent people, the owner of a Greensboro hotel, a former mayor. One of the individuals who has been representing Dennehy is Wade Smith, who was a former law partner of John Edwards. And the request for clemency goes to the governor, and the governor can do one of a couple of different things. She can completely dismiss it, say, nope, you're going to serve out the rest of your sentence. She could reduce it. She could, Governor Perdue, who obviously is an outgoing governor, could say, "This I'm going to amend this sentence so that it's a 25-year sentence or that it's a 15-year sentence. Or she could say, you know, time served. You've served a punishment for this crime, and you're set free." She can also ask for the governor or her staff obviously can ask any questions they want or ask for evidence to see the file, so on and so forth, as she's making this ruling. But this, I think it's just an interesting distinction or important distinction. This isn't a public process. You know, the courts is a fairly most of it is fairly public. But what the governor's weighing and when and if she does make a decision, that doesn't have to be any. There's no timeline. There's no. Public forum that she has to
and
do
no
it
particular
in.
Procedure, right?
No,
I mean, does she entertain any? And so, what's the case that Janet is making? Why does she make this appeal?
She and her legal team are making this case in large part. They're focusing on the good she did in her. She was 23 years old when she committed this crime. She was an exemplary student, a successful Girl Scout. The web pages that talk about her note that she carried the Olympic torch when it came through in 1996 before it ended up in Atlanta. And they're basically saying she has served a time of 10 years for this crime, and it was a horrible prank that went wrong, that she never intended to hurt anyone, and that she should be free. And also, I think some of the subtext that's connected to this is the folks who are supporting her really have an issue with the felony murder law, felony murder rule.
Yeah, we should talk more about that, because in a lot of places you would think that first-degree murder or felony murder requires intent. I wanted to kill you. I had that intention. I made a plan. This obviously is not the case, but because you commit a very reckless act, one that you know could end very badly, and in fact someone dies, according to the state of North Carolina, carries the same consequences. That's the wrinkle in the law here that makes her culpable to such an extent.
One of the questions I had when I started reading about the felony murder law was hypothetical, a bank robbery. You go into a bank and, you know, guns are drawn, you want the bag of cash, the cliche moment. And you leave, and as this moment transpires, somebody has a heart attack and dies. Could you be charged with felony murder? And I asked Howard Newman this question, and he said, "You can always be charged. Whether or not the prosecution can get a conviction is a different story." And he kind of separated that hypothetical that I gave him, and he said, "You know, if you were to go in and hold a gun hold a gun to a teller's head and demand money." That moment, I mean, that bit of shock right there, if that person were to die, he said there's certainly a difference between that happening and maybe somebody who was in the bank as the robbery is taking place, has a pre-existing heart condition or a pacemaker, is hiding under a table, goes into some kind of arrhythmia, and half an hour later goes into cardiac arrest and dies.
And of course, the real point of this law is if you walk into a bank with weapons, guns drawn, somebody's going to get shot. You can argue, "Well, I didn't even know that bank teller. I didn't mean to kill him. You drew a gun. Somebody could get killed." And I think that's the intention of this law. If you do something horribly reckless, and you die in the process, then you really you're culpable for the same crime.
The legal phrase that Howard Newman mentioned to me was proximate cause. Essentially, did the actions directly lead to the death of the person?
So is there a precedent for a case like this, for a clemency, either in North Carolina or elsewhere?
Not that anyone could think of to share or mention to me.
So when you think about the nature of this crime, four people died. It's horrible. You use the word clemency. It's almost hard. You can imagine people trying to put this together. And yet the father of one of the victims has said he agrees that she served enough time, that it was never intentional. Tell us about him and what he has had to say.
Beth Harris's father met with Denahay. She basically asked to meet with parents or family members of all four of the victims, and Beth Harris's father was the only one that agreed to do so, and he has accepted her apology. I don't know if support's the right word or not, but he thinks that she has good to offer to society, and he has written a letter on her behalf to the governor as part of this petition to get her released. The other parents, bear in mind, it was a pair of sisters and one of their boyfriends. Those three, the parents of those three people, are not in favor of her having any kind of reduced sentence. Newman promised them that Denahay would serve out the sentence for the rest of her life, and they all want that to.
Yeah, I was going to ask you more about that, how the prosecution feels about this and what kind of action. Do they need to act in this, or do they are they participants then? Do they make a case to the governor?
They have, again, there's really no procedure to it, but Howard Newman has put together a fact sheet, a compilation of police reports and facts from the case, because there's some evidence or there's some information that is a little bit erroneous. Some of the websites and some of the pleas for her say that it all started as a prank and she set a box of Christmas decorations on fire. I've seen that in a couple of different places, and I asked Howard Newman about it, and he said there was no box of Christmas decorations. It was a futon on a wooden porch that was set on fire.
So they're going to resist this. The prosecution does resist. Two out of the three parents in this case resist as well.
Mm-hmm.
Any indication what the governor might do?
No, there's not. And you know, this ties back to the topic of your last segment with Lamont Armstrong and individuals who are released or convictions are overturned. They can make a petition to receive compensation from the governor. But that's very tough to do. It's really hit or miss. It's a long shot in a lot of cases, and there's no smart bet here, so to speak.
Jeff, thanks so much for being with us.
Sure.
Jeff Tabiri, WUNC's Greensboro Bureau Chief. On the State of Things today from Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro, and we have heard the music of the Martha Bassett Trio featuring Sam Frazier. Sam Frazier is with us today on the State of Things playing that music, and the Martha Bassett Trio, Martha Bassett, Pat Lawrence, and Sam Frazier. Let's hear it for them. Going to play a little more music right now. So, Sam, you've got a beautiful guitar there, which I understand was made right here in Durham, North Carolina. I mean, well, I say that every day. And then once a month I come to Greensboro and forget where I am.
Yeah,
it's right. Thursday, I must be in Greensboro. Right here in Greensboro, North Carolina.
Yeah. By Bob Rigaud. He's a local luthier, and it's just a lovely guitar.
Great stuff. Sounds good. And that's a big part of it. And you're going to be playing at Lucky 32 tonight?
Yep.
And you got a house party coming up in Durham, and I'm right about that. The house party is in Durham.
I have a solo house party coming up in Durham, and tonight we're playing. Martha and I and Pat and I are playing at Lucky 32.
And that all sounds great. And you just released a CD.
I did.
Who's on the CD with you?
Well, Martha's on it. Pat's on it. Snooze is on it.
Britt Uzel.
Yeah, Britt Uzel.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave McCracken and Scott Mannering and Eddie Walker and Andy Ware. Snooze and I have a band called The Numbers with Andy Ware and Eddie Walker. So I like to put the people that I'm playing with these days on the record, and they all did a great job.
All sounds great. Well, I'm going to give you time to play us out, but first I want to remind everybody, Sam Frazier is here. He is playing with the Martha Bassett Trio. Sam Frazier, Martha Bassett, Pat Lawrence, they're going to be at Lucky 32 tonight at 6:30. You can catch Sam's solo house concert in Durham on Saturday from 6 to 8. Go to Sam's website, samfrazier.com. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio. Once again, Sam Fraser.
One, two, three. Except the things that I won't do. Now there's only one or two anyway. Yeah, there's only a couple few things that I won't do, except for maybe you someday. And everywhere I go, even high or low, just want you to know that every day I'm gonna miss you so. Everywhere I go, except for maybe California. There's one thing I won't do, I'll never, never do. That's the thing I did for you yesterday. Anything for you all the way. There's one thing I won't do, I'll never, never do. And that's the thing I did for you yesterday.